All right, everyone, welcome to Value Investing Live. I'm pleased to welcome our guest this week, Tom Russo, the managing member of Gardner, Russo & Quinn and Simprovic Partners. Tom last joined us in October of last year. If you missed that presentation, there is a copy of it here on YouTube as well as on Guru Focus. I would highly recommend you go watch it after we have finished today. As always, please post your questions in the live chat throughout the presentation. Keep in mind, we are going to hold those until we have come to some stopping points in Tom's presentation today. But please also let us know where you're viewing from. We do love to see those international audience members. Without further ado, I'm going to go ahead and hand things over to Tom.
Good afternoon, and please know what a pleasure it is to have a chance to visit with all of you gathered and to think about global value equity investments together. I have been fortunate to have attended and participated in this event for several years, and I hope that there are some of you who have come of age as investors over the course of the past decade, so that if I repeat myself, you will at least find it to be original impression. This is a chance. I'm always reminded of history when markets become sort of extreme in one direction or another. Lessons of history are always very valuable to return to, and in this case, it's sort of the notion of everyday capitalism, where it seems like Joe Kennedy's observation before the Great Crash that even his barber was looking for stock tips meant that the participation for possibly the wrong reason, the trading oriented aspects of our business, penetrated the society that deeply that his barber was long equities. And at that time, similar experience some years back during one of our market manias, I was at the barber shop and my barber was moving along, and all of a sudden he threw down his razor, his clothes, and running down the street at full throng speed, and came back sometime later completely winded, and came back and I said, "What was that all about?" And he said, "Well," he said, "I'm long Everest and Jennings," which was at the time a company that made wheelchairs. And he said that there's a guy who just went by and he had a wheelchair. I wanted to go out and find out whether it's Everest and Jennings and whether he liked it or not. But when I approached him, he thought I was going to harm him. So he started to roll faster and faster and faster. And so there's this lovely scene of an old man chasing down someone in a wheelchair, trying to find out whether it was the right design, the right manufacturer. So we're at a point today where I think there are elements of excess driven by capital and investors with an overly short term orientation. We stay the course for the long term, and find that to still reward. So the story of my own investment career started in 1982 at Stanford Business School, when Professor McDonald hosted Warren Buffett as a guest speaker. And Warren left a couple of ideas that have framed my activities since. And the first one was to avoid agency costs, and the second one was that tax deferral on unrealized gains is the only gift to investors that the tax authorities offer, and so you should build your practice in a way that takes advantage of it, and that really means that you build your practice around investments that can stay for a long time and grow in intrinsic value per share without the need to sell, and so those were two early lessons, and the concept of agency costs is really the ways in which businesses go bad when the decisions made by their managers are at odds with the decisions that the owners would prefer. And that is rife in business today, especially in the U.S., where stock options can allow for vast fortunes to arise if managers please Wall Street. But often in so doing, they're not necessarily playing for the advantage of the owners. And so I'm reminded of this story years ago when I was in France with a company called Switzerland with a company called Pargesa. And the man who ran the investment portfolio there had done a beautiful job over decades. And we were talking about how he got started. And Pargesa had a big position in a nickel company. And for years, nickel was in a complete bear market. And nothing you could do to change the course of a commodity price when you're in a bear market. So they stuck it out. And at some point, there was a massive recovery. And opportunistically, he sold the whole thing and flew to the United States with a big purse full of money and started to look for businesses to buy. And they came upon a company that was attractively priced, throwing off huge amounts of cash, low valuation. It was called Eagle Picture. And he was intrigued. And so he asked his law firm, Weil Gotshal, to take a look at the papers for Eagle Picture, because he was interested in deploying that capital that came about because of the one move. And they read it. And there was a young attorney there who turned out to, over time, became an expert in global bankruptcy. And he said to the representative of the wealthy family that he had read all the materials. It looked like a great business, but he said, there's some problem, I think. It has to do with silicon, and there's some small lawsuits, and they're threatening to become a class action lawsuit. And even though it's five times earnings, you probably won't see anything develop for years to come. It was something that you have to pay attention to. So here's this man who very easily could have taken the proceeds of the business that sold so high, plowed them into Eagle Picture, and walked away from it, and just thought he could appear as a genius for the first 10 years and let the devil care about the rest. Well, he didn't do that. He kept the money and lived to tell the tale of making thoughtful long-term investments. And Eagle Picture took time, but it did go fully bankrupt because of class action lawsuits. And so that's agency costs. In that case, he cared enough about the families who owned the public company that he took a step that financially meant that he would, over most of the 10 years, personally gain less. And so this notion of how do you keep the management focused on building the wealth, in the area that it most typically surfaces isn't where you think it is. You think it would surface by people selling divisions and keeping proceeds illicitly on their own, or doing any number of games with capital and accounting and all the rest. Where it really harms businesses is where it encourages management just not to invest deeply enough, broadly enough to develop a sustainable competitive advantage, but rather to hold the funds, make the earnings that the Wall Street analysts require of them, and over a period of passive safekeeping, retire and walk away. When the real message is, in so many cases, invest like the devil, and go for it because you have a great business and opportunity to secure long-term enduring advantage. That's what you want, and you rarely get it. Even though you want to avoid agency costs, it's hard to do. And the way we've worked our business is that we look glowingly on family control companies where the boards still are influenced heavily by the families, and the families can provide enough support that even if the businesses languish for the period of time at which investments take place, the management need not fear activists or takeover, any other thing, because the family can offer control and protect the management, and allow them to go down their merry way on creating wealth. And so that's the concept of agent costs. In 1982, Warren warned against that. He also, as I said, applauded the notion that you could have unrealized capital gains grow over time. Since I saw him speak, the shares have gone from $900 a share to $435,000, and not a penny of money was owed on those hundreds of thousands of dollars of appreciation because no shares were sold. And so what you end up looking for, and the last point he made, and it was a fascinating time to hear him speak in 1982, was just at that time, the definition of margin of safety was changing from reflecting the price paid, and if there's a deep enough discount from the price paid to stated value, then you would develop your margin of safety just based off that discount, to a world where the intrinsic value is more important, and it's mostly the search for a business that enjoys competitive advantage, often based on intellectual capital. So, but the concept of what it means to have the margin of safety went from price paid to competitive advantage, and so that was underway when we were there. So put it all together, you will need to reinvest free cash flow if you're going to have a business that can compound its intrinsic value. And so you need to have a business that has the capacity to be reinvested into. And for me, over most of my career, it's been investing through global brands. And my thought there has been that the brands have been in countries for decades. They've been a mark of prosperity, a mark of wealth, and highly esteemable and appealing. And it's only when the world starts to move forward, like it has over the past 30 years, that you have those brands, long coveted, highly aspirational, can accompany families as they advance economically, and enjoy the benefit of price inelastic demand. You see it in things like Carnation Milk and instant coffee and a host of other things that are among the first things that consumers buy when they start to have a disposable income. So we like the brands that have longevity with the consumers, that it's they're embedded in their sense of aspiration, and so we look forward to that. And so that's an orientation, global investing. When Warren came to our class, he obviously had no investments overseas historically, but the professor invited him, was a longstanding global investor, urged his students to become global investors as well. And I took up that mantle because of my belief that the international companies provided good reinvestment opportunities. You also get population growth internationally that we don't see here, and that leads to disposable income growth. The other thing that you pick up, if you're going to rely upon your portfolio company managers to take you around the world opportunistically to make and extend investments, you probably want to have multilingual and multicultural management. And I've shared this thought with others, but if you wanted to understand what I mean about multilingual, I would ask the audience, who I don't get to see, unfortunately, through this Zoom, but I would ask you collectively, how many of you speak four languages? I don't think I'd see many hands up. And then, you know, because basically the international companies like Nestle, top 100 managers, all, I would say, speak at least three or four languages, and we're really comfortable American, single language, and so that's an advantage, I think, as you want to move your way around the world to have fluency. At the same time, multiculturalism is a good thing to see within the group that you're going to rely upon extending your wealth, and multiculturalism can be accessed by asking of yourselves who your favorite cricket player is, and you can realize that cricket is a sport of 1.5 billion, maybe 2 billion fans, doesn't happen to have much currency in the U.S. But I look to invest in markets where the population is growing, incomes are growing, they tend to be foreign markets, and they throughout much of Asia align with something like cricket, not baseball. So there you have it. Now, for those management teams, multilingual, multicultural, and all of the rest, if they're going to invest for the future, they're going to have to have the capacity to suffer upfront in the near term. And that's a lesson that Berkshire Hathaway really has taught all of us, I think most forcefully. As many businesses as he's purchased, the really great ones, often he's able to buy at a substantial discount to what they're worth because other investors couldn't absorb the burden on income that Berkshire Hathaway has easily absorbed by virtue of Warren's share control and by virtue of his knowledge that reported interim operating profit doesn't really indicate the ultimate results to intrinsic value that might arise from so many of the investments that he's made over the years. And we'll touch upon a couple of them just to give a sense. And Nestle, the same thing. They've been willing to invest far more than Wall Street would suggest they should, because of, I think, their Swiss orientation. They're not family controlled, but they do have just a long-term mindedness that somehow comes from the atmosphere above Lake Geneva in Vevey, Switzerland. SAB Miller has, when they were consolidating, they were acquiring businesses, and Brown-Forman is probably one of the great examples for us. In the mid 1980s, that's a pretty quick story. Brown-Forman had a substantial bourbon business that was languishing because the flavors and favorites and the beverage world had migrated to alcoholic soda, something like Bartles and James and others, California Cooler. They were taking people away from bourbon. Brown-Forman was a bourbon company. The shares were weak. What happened is just even though the families controlled the business and could have encouraged the management just to keep growing, they listened instead to an investment bank who had a California Cooler business for sale, which the family bought for $600 million. And it was written off almost within the second or third year that they owned it. And at that point, the family, this is 1986, declared that they'd had enough of trying to diversify away from the bourbon cycles and that they would simply dedicate for the next, as far as they can see, the free cash flow from domestic bourbon to growing international. And immediately they started to show pressure on reported profits, but the family controlled the company and they were willing to let the investment proved to be as burdensome as it should have been, given how they wanted to develop it. You have to set up a new brand like that. You have to go into markets, 50 of them, that have not historically heard of bourbon. They've not historically heard of Jack Daniels, and they've not historically met with any of these people before, and those people can't speak the language or play the sports games anyways. But at the end of the day, Brown-Forman family controlled sort of sent packing any advisors on what to do other than just grow the business organically, suffer the upfront burden on reported income, and then let the business go through loss making to the sort of the recovery, and then it starts to go up. And at some point, if you make it past 100,000 cases in a market with a brand like theirs, you start to show profits, and as it grows from there, all is good. And what it takes, however, is a steel set of nerves to live through the period of investment spending. They did, and it flourished, and the shares over that period of time went from sort of $2.50 a share to $70 a share, where they currently around where they trade today. And the beauty of it is, since you know all along the way they had understated their profits because of the burden from startup, it was relatively certain trajectory. So with that, I would say, you know, what we have is the capacity for management to suffer those downdrafts in reported profits, secure the knowledge that with a family-controlled company, you aren't likely to lose control of it to a takeover artist or to a activist. So I would stop now to open up the floor to any questions about how we frame the investments that we're looking for, what we seek.
Okay. We do have a couple questions related to what you were just talking about.
Yep.
The first was, how do you assess if the company has the opportunity to reinvest?
Well, I think it's a function of the addressable market, you know, just how big you assess the addressable market to be. I think in this, I may have a slide up here. I assume that the technology is fine. The lower left-hand corner, you'll see the name of two companies that are large holdings. One's Richemont and one's MasterCard. In each case, we believe that we had market leaders through their portfolio, through their activities, and a massively underpenetrated market. And so when we invested in MasterCard in 2011, they had only 15% of the global commerce. 85% of global commerce was, at the time, still conducted through cash and through checks, not through network exchanges and credit cards. And so, you know, in the case of Richemont, which owns Cartier and Van Cleef and a host of luxury companies, we were quite fond of their portfolio, especially Cartier and Van Cleef. They're global jewelers, and 85% at the time, maybe 90 at the time we started investing of global jewelry, 90% of it was unbranded. And so with a strong brand, only occupying 15% of the total global sales in jewelry, you had the phenomenon where we felt jewelry sales would grow because of prosperity where it does settle around the world. And that the share of jewelry sales that were branded would grow from 85% to something much, much, much higher. And in the case of MasterCard, it's been amazing. MasterCard's grown its gross dollar volumes by nearly 13% every year since we've owned it. And after a dozen years of that kind of growth, they still face a world that until recently was 85% conducted in cash and in credit cards. And one of the interesting sidebars of the COVID experience has been that for the first time ever, MasterCard and Visa have a chance to go after that 85% that's been stubbornly resisting the payment systems. And it's because of COVID. It turns out that there are enough people who have become entirely germophobic in the U.S. and around the world that they have raced to adopt a tap and pay version of a credit card, which allows you to just put above the register your card with a proper bug inserted into it, and that allows it to process without you having to pick up a germy pen or to touch a germy button. You have to do nothing but swipe over the meter. Now that is causing, for the first time ever, pockets of cash and transactions that always were done through cash and checks to start to convert, and people are now using their card to just tap and go $1 or $2, whereas before they would only use the cards for larger amounts. And so that's an unusual side note from the COVID. MasterCard's quite a large holding for us, and so we've been pleased to see the migration accelerate. So I'd say those are two companies that have huge addressable markets that were unmet. You can think about, and so that's really the exercise. You have to go through the business. Think of the structure of the company and the marketplace, and see how much of the marketplace is currently served, and then at what level. As I said, through Richemont, it's a question of segmenting the market. Once you decide that it's a market that does have enough capacity, then you want to build in the opportunity to start with an offering that then can be scaled up in price or down in price, depending on how fast you want to grow your market share.
All right.
Good question.
I think we can go ahead and just keep going. But thank you for all that. Right. That was really great.
Gotcha. So we have found that and the best way to harness the long-term mindedness of management and the reinvestment likelihood that's done for the right reason has come about with family-controlled companies. And what our thought there is that if management wants to follow what's best for the intrinsic value of the business and grow it despite accelerating and deepening reported losses as a result of the startup expenses, if they want to do that, they would most want to be in a company that the family still controls, so the family could say to anyone else who tried to take them over in these periods of downturn reported results that they should just go away, leave us alone, because the family has a view of the future that they're executing upon, and that's it. So we have roughly half of our money in businesses that are the family controlled. The largest of them, obviously, is Berkshire. And Berkshire has made our investors a tremendous amount of money by taking on that opportunity that arises when an investment becomes available that will do nothing but weigh upon near-term results while building long-term wealth. And they've done that magnificently, whether it was the equity puts that they issued years ago for $15 billion, or whether it was Geico, which they bought and have grown enormously. Anything that they've done has usually had the benefit of a better price than you would normally get because of the upfront burden that most company managements try to steer away from. So that's it. The family control is something that's quite important. The question is often asked: how can you tell whether a family is going to be a proper steward for all shareholders or just serve their own narrow interests? And my answer is that you can tell that. You can tell that by your interaction with the management. And so we had an investment, a longstanding investment in Comcast, which is a Pennsylvania-based cable company run by a controlling family called the Roberts. And they were extraordinary. They were leaders in the technological evolution, a revolution of how do you deliver images and entertainment to homes. They had a high pricing strategy. They did everything. And as leaders in the cable industry, they were. Just down the road, there was another Pennsylvania-based cable company, family-owned, which adopted a completely different relationship with the company. The company, controlled by the family, owned cable systems that they used to buy and sell. So there's a threat of cherry-picking, selling off the company's holdings to buy themselves personally and back and forth. And there's no way to monitor that. And so most companies avoid allowing that to happen. In their case, they allowed it, and family members had all sorts of positions within the company that they did not deserve. And most importantly, when you visited with Adelphia, which is the name of the Regas family's company, you recognize that mostly all the people who worked there were largely second rate. And by contrast, at Comcast, those who work there were really quite driven, quite dynamic, leaders in the industry, desiring of creating new levels of entertainment, new technology. They were terrific. And so you can tell the difference between Regas and Roberts in general by just visiting the business and kicking the tires, which is what you're really required to do when you're making investments in any case. So the question about how do you know how big the market is, there's the other example of that was the African beer business, which we became involved with in the mid-1980s when we first invested in Heineken. And you'll see there that the market, it's interesting that the market of consumption in sub-Saharan Africa has been 400 million barrels consumed per year, but only 100 million barrels of that were bottled. The others were consumed in village centers where there would be, you know, homemade vats of this beer-like substance, and it would be ladled out in individual pouring. But the actual official beer business was really quite small, only 100 million barrels consumed among, I don't know, 1.5 billion Africans. And it was out of a total of 400 million barrels consumed. So there was three times the size of the market that they could participate in. And so that's a nice size market. And over time, Heineken and SABMiller, which is now part of Anheuser-Busch, have done a big job consolidating those consumers into the modern trade, the bottled and refrigerated, branded and taxed, and the less lethal. The historic stuff, which was consumed in villages, was really quite lethal and unregulated business. We also happen to have businesses in the spirits world, as I said, starting back in 1986 with the Brown-Forman. It remains a almost a 3% position for the firm. And the business has truly grown along with Brown-Forman and its counterparts through the investments that they bore. You now have a much bigger business, and at the same time, we still have enormous untapped potential. If you scale the opportunity in China, 1.5 billion cases of spirits are consumed a year, and in our Western companies, Pernod and Brown-Forman, collectively sell 1.5 million cases to that Chinese market. So 1.5 billion cases consumed. Our companies, with their valiant efforts underway, have penetrated them 0.1%. So we have reasons to believe that will continue to grow. And the market's very large at the moment and will continue to grow because 25 million new consumers each year in India come to market. So they become legal drinking age, which is, I think, 18. They become old enough and in size, 25 million of them a year. So it's a market that will be addressed for quite a long time. So those are my main observations that I think the Geico example was so instructive to me. I'll spend a moment on that. When Warren and Charlie bought Geico, it only had 1.5 million insureds, and they thought that they were buying the best system. As you know, it was no insurance agent. It was direct to the consumer. It was very, 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 very low claims. Everything about it was terrific. And the only thing that kept it from being a meaningful business was that the fact that every new insured that you put on the books had a first-year loss of $250. So if you brought on a new policy, you'd have to provide for $250 worth of losses. Obviously, they go away, and the next year they make $150 or $200 of profit from the operations. But the first year, when you grow, you have to bear that up front. Berkshire, as I said, had about 1.5 million policies, and that would have meant that they were generating $225 million worth of operating profit, somewhere around there, off their existing business. But if they were to grow their business by another million, you would take that reported profit and turn it into losses, because the losses of $250 per new insured would burden new insured, and so the business would go from making $500 million to losing, that reality is what kept Geico independent, but growing relatively slowly. For Berkshire, the math is entirely different. They look at that and say, what a terrific investment for just a reported loss, which isn't ongoing, just a reported loss of $250. We can create something that's worth $2,500. And to their proper analysis, they do that all day long. And today, Geico now has 13.5 million insured, up from the 1.5 million they started with. And if you apply 2,500 as the lifetime value of those insured, you come up with well over $20 billion of incremental intrinsic value as a result of management's willingness to suffer, the capacity to suffer those years when the when they were largely growing, and as a result burdened heavily by upfront investment burden on reported profits. So I would stop there and welcome any questions about today's markets or about what we've spoken about thus far.
Let's see. Going back through here. Are you worried about inflation today? Are you more in the transitory camp, or do you think it's more likely to be permanent and disruptive to markets?
Worried, transitory. And one of the things that has been such a hallmark of the last two decades in the world has been the ability for those new markets that take on the responsibility for manufacturing to continue to be able to deliver ever more amounts of manufactured products at ever lower prices. And so the world has become relatively dependent upon that, but as a result, it has kept the pricing pressure down because of the availability of adequate substitutes that exists from parts of the world that that are only coming into their economic strength. Think of Vietnam, for example. That would be a good example of a country which has become very, very involved with global commerce, and their presence means that the likelihood that the pricing will go up without any kind of recourse, a little less likely. Right now, we're going through the craziest time imaginable. Hasbro just reported this past week that a container that would have brought into the United States historically a load of Tonka trucks would have historically cost them $2,500 to deliver. This year, the same truck container, if they could get it, would cost them $25,000. So you have to sell a lot of Tonka trucks to make up the additional $22,500 just for the sea journey, and you have to pass it through, and so you can imagine the impact per unit that will have as they unload that container full of wonderful children's delight. Now the trick is, it is a wonderful children's delight, and the child intended to receive that Tonka truck won't be satisfied if they trade down to a store brand or a lesser brand. And so our preference long term, and if you look at the portfolio that I oversee continuing to this day, is for businesses that have powerful brands. And those brands are designed to allow the management to raise prices to protect the operating margin against inflation by price as a result of price inelastic demand. So that's the story. I think that the world will eventually become less clumsy. It's the clumsiest time you've ever heard in terms of corporate management's asking for forgiveness because they can't find chips, they can't do this, they can't do that. It's an extraordinary time, And I do think societies will re-engage in a way that will deliver what's needed on a more regular pattern with less extreme negotiations in terms of labor and pricing of all sorts of goods and services and commodities. So now there is another ingredient in terms of inflation, which is interest rates. And my view on interest rates is that we run the risk of a more systemic challenge as the world decides if and whether they want to help us hold those trillions of dollars of stimulus money that we've been and that we're about to again extend. It seems like we have little choice. It looks like we will continue to extend. We already have done, and all of that has to find a home someplace. And I think it's hard to believe that will find a home where interest rates remain quite low. And so there's that risk of interest rates going up simply to help clear the price of our debt. And that's something that I do think we have to pay deep attention to because of the fact that discount rate is so determinative in figuring out what businesses are worth. The discount rate obviously is what brings it all back to present value. And that's an area where we have extraordinarily high values from companies that are able today to discount back their longest earnings at a 2%, not 5, not 7, which is more normal for long-dated bonds. And if we go back to those higher, more normal long-dated bonds, some of that excess value will be lost as the discount rate goes up. So near term, I think we'll make it through the congestion and all the difficulties that we've seen with trade, let's just say, causing expensive pressures. Think of oil, for example. A $35 per barrel payment to you by the oil companies in the middle of last year converted to today's $80+ per barrel that you would have to pay to get the same barrel. It's an extraordinary time. I've never seen anything like in my life. And as Warren and Charlie say, it'll be interesting to see how it all works out. But there's really very, it's very hard to have a clairvoyance on this. Good question. It's certainly on the minds of regulators as well, the Fed and all sorts of folks. So great question. Okay. What else?
We'll have one more question in regards to your Nestle investment. Audience member says, how do you reconcile the capacity to reinvest its profit in emerging markets with its current payout ratio of 100%? Shouldn't it reinvest its profits generated from the developed markets?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Nestle has gone, has and continues to go through an enormous amount of restructuring under the leadership of Mark Snyder, and so there are businesses that they're buying and selling, and my understanding is that they're committed to paying out a percentage of reported income, as do so many companies. I don't think they've been particularly dynamic about the way in which they consider the dividend. Now, that doesn't mean that they haven't implemented a $20 billion share buyback and then refunded it with, I think, a second $20 billion share buyback. And they've just come through this pandemic in such a fascinating way. They have, over the years, under current leadership, invested in venture pools dedicated to the advancement of non-traditional food and beverage and vitamins and supplements. And during the pandemic, they have had a sort of an inside track on acquiring extraordinary businesses that they would not have been able to acquire, or certainly not at the price that they enjoyed, were it not for COVID. And two of the businesses, one of which is called Amimmune, is the global leader in vaccines and preventative treatment for peanut allergies, which actually impact and threaten the lives of usually younger users of peanut allergies. And during the pandemic, the venture capital pool that held control over that business wanted to sell. And they had a big problem because the FDA had granted them the exclusive right to sell a product, which is called Amimmune, to protect against peanut allergies. But in order to activate it, they had to go allergist practice door by door and stocking them up and showing them how to handle the product because it was complicated. Nobody in the world of COVID would go out and make those calls. And so even though there was a desire to sell the business from the pool, and Berkshire and Nestle had an investment in that pool, only they had the appetite to buy it. And so they were able to buy this wonderful business before the market had a chance to see just how great it will be when it has the access to those allergists. And they were able to buy it at a very knockdown price because of the inability for other potential buyers to due diligence, to even go to the factory to look at what they would be buying. And so Nestle's wisdom of having made investments earlier on that did nothing but end up under-reporting profits because they invest in pools that didn't show them any income. When it came time to buy it, they were able to buy the business at a low price. It's a terrific testimony to their conservative nature. They also had an investment similarly in a company called Freshly. And the exact same situation happened there. The market shut down. The venture capitalists, I think, became weak-kneed. Nobody else in the world could look at the business because they wouldn't travel. And Nestle, because of its familiarity, having been a board member and an investor, was able to buy that business for an attractive valuation. And the last business that called Freshly's is one of those companies today that are so emblematic, whereby they are all about heavy upfront spending as they absorb the customer acquisition costs in pursuit of a lifetime value that comes about generously if they can withstand the competitive dynamics and become the last man standing, the last company standing. And that battle between the burden of spending out the customer acquisition cost on a regular basis in the hopes of capturing the lifetime value because of your winner take all success is something that is very typical today across so many businesses. It is finally this notion of pain today for gain tomorrow, which we've seen since the early 1980s with Berkshire, has become quite ubiquitous. And one of the examples I find so fascinating is Google, which from its infant moment described in their offering memorandum why it was that they would never let anybody outside the founding families have voting shares. And they said it was because they wanted to have the ability to survive the expense, the burden, the upfront pain of a new project. Like, I don't know, think about the Waymo mapping system, the investment in the electric car, the investment in maps, Google Maps, any number of things that they hunker down on, verily in the medical field right now, where they hunker down with all the resources that were required without regard to the losses on the income statement, has allowed them to enjoy, you know, the benefits of cloud, of all the other things I just mentioned. And they never would have been there if they had to balance revenue versus expenses in a measured fashion, so they never showed any losses on a quarterly basis, which is what, sad to say, many investors want from companies. And it's just not realistic. If you really want to build value, you can't do it with those constraints, as they found out. Fast forward, 8 years later, the business had become somewhat sclerotic because the decisions that were critical and needed to be made could only be made by those owners of the company who held all the votes. And they were increasingly distracted by big boats or big houses or big satellites, big rocket ships, whatever people today find their way to when they have such substantial amounts of wealth, that they weren't actually present and accounted for regularly enough to keep the ship moving fast and forward at Alphabet. And so at some point, just a couple of years ago, they appointed Sundar to be the sole CEO and then went around their merry way doing as they were. But it's a very interesting example of what Buffett says is all too often the case on Wall Street, which is not bad ideas at the start, but good ideas taken to the extreme. At the point when they were really grinding to a halt at some levels, they needed an active and singular CEO, and boy, did they ever get a good one, who then in turn gave the cloud business at Amazon, at Alphabet, a similar strong leader with a single voice. And that, I think, has turned to be a meaningful inflection period for the prospects of Alphabet, and helps to describe why it is that we have just over 10% of our funds in Alphabet and are comfortably with that. So, good question about Nestle. Somehow we found our way to then thereby celebrate Alphabet as well.
All right, let's keep it going, Tom. Thanks for that.
Sure. Any other questions?
Not at the moment. So let's just keep going.
Geico, we went over capacity itself. This is the a spreadsheet or has the experience from SAB Miller, which we owned a sizable amount of back at this time. And they were investing heavily across markets around the world and showing good revenue growth because they were growing. But the burden of generating this revenue growth in startup fashion, the customer acquisition cost during this period of time, they were securing market share and revenues. But the margin was impacted, and they didn't really have a shareholder base that allowed them to have that type of pressure on operating margins, unlike Heineken. And as a result, they ended up falling prey to an acquirer, not just any acquirer, but Anheuser-Busch InBev. So. Heineken, by contrast, we have Nestle here. It's a summary of the different ways in which Nestle has continued to shape its portfolio, but they really have it's an 11% position for us, and so it commands a lot of our attention, it's a testimony to the positive disruptive effect of a I think a brilliant leader and a concentrated portfolio with market share dominance in pet food, which flourished during the pandemic because of the clinging to pets by increasing millions of people worldwide. They have the worldwide leader in pet food. Great coffee at home is one of their campaigns, and they have a $10 billion business with Starbucks that deliver Starbucks worldwide to grocery stores and other venues, entertainment and out of home, and so they have a pillar in coffee, they have a pillar in pet food, they enjoy massive growth in revenue from both of those core holdings during the pandemic, and in the process of doing, they received a meaningful payback for the investments that they had made in online commerce, e-commerce, which grew in the case of pet food, I think from 7% to over 15% of its business. You can imagine pet food is a perfect business for the consumer for e-commerce because the requirement to carry around the serving sizes of pet food, you know, is enough to break your back. And so it's a business that flourished. And it's our belief that the pet business will continue to flourish. The coffee business, where they did have an out-of-home business like Blue Bottle, languished over much of the past 18 months because of closure. And that business is coming back. And they've been recently consolidating their health and wellness business, which is a lot of. Now, this is probably the last one we'll go over. It's Heineken. Heineken. I first met management at Heineken in 1986, and when I arrived, the CFO at the time said, "Why are you here?" I said, "Well, we want to invest in your company." He said, "Well, that's odd." They really had very few outside investors. It was an 80% European business, and it was under the aging watch of Freddie Heineken. We felt that the business had the only global brand, and it had an expressed global appetite to grow from that 80% business in Europe because of its declining consumer profile. In other words, people were getting quite old quite fast. And so they began the process when we first invested in them in 1986 of marching forward. And since then, the business has grown. Today that it has, I think it's close to 50% of their business is in developing emerging markets, and it's all because of growth around Western Europe, the area that they worried about, never did recover forcefully. But it's become almost irrelevant because of the investments that cash flow funded. For example, from a standing start, the business 2 years ago had $1 billion profit from Mexico and $500 million from Vietnam, both markets where they really didn't have much of a business 10 years ago. And they certainly had no business when I met with the family in 1986. Brazil is a great example of how a wise family can help out dramatically growing their business. And we like to partner with them. Strong brand, emerging market focus, so there's a huge TAM. The family willing to suffer the burdens of upfront investment, and off they went in Brazil. 5 years ago, they were encouraged, in fact, demanded by Wall Street, to buy the second largest Brazilian brewer so that they had a toehold into Brazil, or expanded their toehold into Brazil. And they took a look at the business, they took a look at their appetite, and even though Wall Street clamored for them to pay $5.2 billion to buy the business, they walked away. The shares were battered because Wall Street claimed that they didn't have courage and this and that. And off that business went to the victor, which was Kirin Beer, who was buying it at the time with very, very strong Japanese currency, and they thought that they would be diversifying. Anyways, fast forward 4 years later, Kirin realized that they They couldn't run it. They had lost $1 billion and they put it up for sale, at which time all of Wall Street suggested that Heineken would be crazy to even touch it. They should not look at it, avoid it like the plague. And instead of such advice this time around, after they were last told that they had to buy it for $5 billion, they're now instructed that they couldn't buy it for for reasons, and they did buy it for $720 million. So they passed on what they were told they couldn't live without at $5 billion, and they bought it instead for $700 million, plus or minus. And then, you know, this business has, over the very short period of time since they bought it, become the largest market in the world for Heineken, which is obviously by far and away their most profitable business because of its pricing and the position. And they have, once they acquired it, they have driven the success of Heineken in that market remarkably. The only thing that's slowing them down is today, they may do 10 million hectoliters of beer in Brazil, of Heineken, I should say, in Brazil. And they've run out of capacity. And so this year, they're investing in 2 million new hectoliters of capacity. Next year, they'll put on 2 million more hectoliters, business that was demanded for this year, but they couldn't find the product. And so the next year, they're going to put on an additional 7.5 million. So you've got basically 11 million new hectoliters of Heineken in Brazil, which shows you the virtue that you get from being independent minded, passing when they were told they had to buy it, and buying it when they were told that they had to pass on it. So that has helped the shares advance from $9 a share to $80 a share today over the period since 1986. It's a business that they can continue to grow and representative value along the way. I heard some rumbling. Any questions? Okay.
I think back on. Here we go. Sorry, I've had a high volume of questions, so I've just been trying to go through them a little bit. So a lot of them are related to, they're wondering about your investment in Alibaba.
Yes.
They're wondering if you're worried about like what's going to happen when the stock gets delisted, and whether, where's the other one that had a question? Because it's kind of a two-part. And then what do you think about the Chinese government's approach in regards to its VIE structure, considering that it's illegal for non-Chinese people to own it currently in the Chinese listing anyway?
Yeah. I think our sense of Alibaba was really shaped by the comments that we received from our portfolio companies. We have long witnessed Heineken, Jameson's, Cartier, Van Cleef, increasingly dealing with the Tmall luxury pavilion, and they claim that they cannot operate in China without access to that distribution, and that, you know, we look for businesses where you can say that they cannot do without something. Those are our calling cards. If we can find, and that can be Geico, it can be Heineken if you're a brand loyal Heineken drinker. It could be See's Chocolate, whatever it is. In the case of our portfolio companies, they find it very hard to find an equal service provider to the quality that they get through Alibaba. So that's one thing. We feel like on the commerce side, we're covered. If we take all of their investments, including what's left of Ant and the hundreds of small startup investments that they have that will come public someday and are going through the acquisition, you know, the customer acquisition cost loss-making period, if you add all of those up, and you know, give the commerce business the credit for being as steady as it is, I think it's grown 20% during the last reporting period, even with the kind of tumult. You then end up with something which will be extremely valuable, and they own it entirely, which is the cloud business. And that will probably do close to $15 billion this year. It's an independently reported business, and through that, there's AI components that the users of the cloud services access, and so that business is extremely valuable, as you see with network services at Amazon and with Google. And they have by far and away the biggest presence in cloud in China. I think twice the size of the second closest to them, and so the whole package comes together. If you value of businesses to around 6x EV to EBITDA, and that's a mighty good discount for a business that has the growth characteristics that it enjoys. As far as the regulatory scheme, many of the things that they and their counterparts are being asked to do are useful for business. So the payment systems. The credit bureau, the historic lack of a credit bureau, and the risks that were exposed by that are now being addressed through the regulatory demands, and the companies that were excessive in their discounting. They talk about companies that price below their own costs. That whole line of business was funded by outside capital, and it's drying up. There are hosts of areas where what they're putting in place is more more mature. It's not all that difference from a renegade America 150 years ago, when Ida Tarbell wrote her book about difficult business practices of the Standard Oil Company. There are a lot of similarities. And at the end of the day, I think the Chinese understand that they need Western capital, that they need Western capital on terms that are agreeable. And they need Western technology, and they need Western markets. And so they can push as far as they go, but I don't think they'll go beyond that. Now, there is a risk that they go beyond it, first of all, because of Xi's political needs. Then there's a possibly greater risk that outside their control, somebody with a loose finger, sets off a missile in Taiwan or something else in the South China Sea. There are not exogenous risks. Those are risks that are really quite specific and quite important. And there's no way of knowing how something that could be unintended would be deactivated if it started to escalate. And so for that macro kind of context fear over the possibility of a loose finger, we've kept the position at about a 2.5-3% position. And we think that that's a position warranted by valuation, and also somehow balancing the risk of some of these political, regulatory, or else even sovereignty oriented conflicts that continue to consume the regulators in China.
All right.
I do think, for example, as I mentioned, we've tried to introduce Western spirits into China, and they like them. They have a fancy for them, but they're not that well penetrated. They're sort of 1.5% of the market. Less than that. It's less than 1% of the market at the moment. And there's recently, with Alibaba, two things that happened. One was, an incident that took place at an after work venue where all of the workers in a division of Alibaba were required to go and socialize. And that is one thing that we'd like to see change, because it would be much better for our business if there was a more balanced and diversified presence in consuming spirits, because that would allow Absolute and Jameson's and a host of other, Martell is an example of businesses that we own that are there and ready to go, but they just don't have the sponsorship because everyone in some level is forced to conform with what the business folks require of them. So that's a promise. And the other thing is simply that the company has had some recent skirmishes that had to do with the workplace standards for privacy and conduct within the organizations, and that just has to go. And so that'll be part of the conversation. There are a host of observations, but the bottom line is we think commerce is their long suit. They do it better than anyone else, and our companies tell them that as they use Alibaba increasingly to get to their consumer around the world. 200 million of the 1.2 billion consumers, I think, are non-Chinese. So the government's made a host of proposals that reduce the operating risk of the country just in time for Evergrande, misnamed company, just in time for them to implode. So, you know, at some level, all of this may have been a denouement to the reality that they faced a collapsing Evergrande, and there you have it. I think they put together steps in an effort to try to help rein back excesses so they can avert more Evergrandes. There's a possibility that the state-owned enterprise is built so much and so poorly that there could be, you know, debt pockets unmeetable. So we'll see. But I think our exposure is measured, and our belief in the underlying three businesses, commerce, luxury, and cloud, are deep enough that we'll stay the course. I would ask the questioner back what their thoughts are, but I can't. So tell me what else you got.
Let's see. We also have a question. Let me just lost it. Where'd it go?
Yeah.
Oh, well, shoot, where'd it go? Sorry, I scrolled too far down. I believe it was about, here it goes, Philip Morris.
Ooh, gosh.
What are your thoughts, given its process, since it recently was told it must stop the sale of the sale and import of the IQOS tobacco device in the U.S.?
You know, the issue about IQOS, I mean, first of all, we hold a position for those investors who wish to do so in Philip Morris of roughly 6%. It trades at an attractive price with an attractive yield, and it has invested nearly $10 billion in developing a portfolio that has reduced risk characteristics, mainly heat not burn, recognizing as they do that it's the combustion of the tobacco leaves that causes cancer, not the nicotine. And they've come to that realization at the FDA, and they've said that that Philip Morris had the right to market their IQOS in North America and elsewhere. They had the right to market it as a product that is a reduced risk product and will help people separate from cigarettes. So that's where they stand now. They're backing off a little bit on that communication. Some other companies are getting approved. So it's like watching law be made. People say, you know, it's like making baloney. A lot of things go into this negotiation right now. The bottom line, however, is that the product that Philip Morris has called IQOS has had over 70% effectiveness in helping smokers abandon combusted cigarettes. And that is something that the FDA has to recognize because it has such massive positive health consequences. So that's it. It's political. BAT, which bought RJR Tobacco, has an allegation against Philip Morris for trade theft, which will probably require that Philip Morris cross-license the product that is under dispute so that they can get to market. And that wouldn't be the worst outcome. the world is ganging up. The world is really understanding the business, and they're trying to go after aspects of it in the U.S., which doesn't affect Philip Morris, and the rest of the world, which would affect Philip Morris. For instance, what was it? One state, Washington, D.C., I guess it was just this month, banned the use of menthol flavoring in cigarettes. Well, you know, that's a confiscation of what made that particular product desirable to that particular consumer. And there are steps like that taking place. And so it is a business that will be ever declining. It's declining faster. Philip Morris has said that they want to be out of combusted cigarettes by 2050. And I think they've said they want to be down to 50% only combusted by 2000. And I think it was 25. They're already at close to 30% of their business is non-combusted cigarettes. And all of those, every one of those consumers was a former smoker. And every one of those consumers has by and large quit forever.
Yeah, I definitely can see the benefit of those things. I know a lot of people who use them too. Let's see. Another question is in regards to Heineken. How can you see in the P&L statement the implication of its capacity to suffer and be sure that poor earnings are due to investments and not to a leakage in the moat?
It's a very good question. It's a really, really good question. I don't worry as much about the leakage in the moat, as I said, with some of their brands having such powerful appeal. You know, the Heineken in Brazil, which is their largest competitor's home market, Ambev and ABI, they have a business that's able to grow by more than 100% over the next 3 years as they ramp up the new capacity. So, but right now, there are a major number of disruptions in Brazil that are causing one-off expenses to mask the true operating profitability. And those have to do with the requirement that they now self-deliver portions of their portfolio instead of using a Coca-Cola bottler. So that's a disruption. When you start up breweries, they don't operate at full capacity. And they're starting up a lot of capacity over the course of the next 18 months. Those are non-recurring. Vietnam is under such massive meltdown. It's probably the most disruptive of all countries in the world at the moment. And Heineken had by far and away the largest the share of the profit pool for Vietnamese beer. They had $500 million of profits a couple of years ago. And with COVID rampant as it is, you know, they'll probably be lucky to earn 20% of that. It'll be a very big burden. But they love Tiger, they love Heineken, they love Heineken 00 alcohol free. You just go down the list. They have La Rue in the inner parts of Vietnam, which is a less expensive beer. I mean, there's just so many ways that they're serving that portfolio. But they're up against. They must be our most impacted of all COVID companies right now. Adversely, and so we know by speaking with the company the commitment they have to sustainability and the amount of money that they're spending on meeting ESG requirements and sustainability, and that's all happening right now. It's the first time many of these are being put to work for the first time, and so those will be a reporting profit headwind. But you ask a really good question. Whoever asked the question, it's a really good one. And I think in each case, it's just sort of specific questions about the specific areas where they have shortfalls, and then it's our conviction that when we hear the answers, that we feel like they've satisfied our fear over the degradation of that category in that portfolio.
Definitely. All right. So I think we may take one or two more questions, but this one is in regard to, they say, do you think that private luxury companies like Rolex, Patek Philippe, Audemars Piguet, etc., have an advantage over public luxury companies? The private ones seem to have higher product demand.
Well, those are some of the best businesses ever. You add L'Oreal and Hermes to those three names, and you might just go to, you know, just go to bed and retire, because those are the best, you know, some of the best brands you can find anywhere. And you know, I think I would say the perfect example of what we aspire to, which is that they are as good as they are because whenever they've been asked to take the steps that that do or do not ensure their long-term viability, they took the steps that ensured their long-term viability. So, you know, they have, I think Rolex doesn't sell through their the traditional networks, and they've built an extremely strong business, the most profitable, I think, the watch business in the country, in the world, rather, through the benefits of the way that they go to market, the image, the advertising, you know, that steady hand in advertising, even when markets are down, even when you don't think it's going to drive business, but just to make sure you reaffirm your consumer that they made the right choice. Overcoming cognitive dissonance is something that the companies you mentioned have done better. And, you know, for whatever reason, even though the main companies, you know, LVMH and Richemont are both still run effectively by the families, they just haven't had the same steadfast resolve to see down markets through and not to become swept away with these really ebullient markets when they come along. That's what harmed Richemont so much over the past 15 years, is that they just sort of drank the Kool-Aid and ended up with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars of watches that the market just didn't accept. And the process by which they had to return those through dealers and destroy them and all the rest, you know, it's very costly. And I do think that the independent ones, it's also, I'd say the other thing is, you know, they're also very focused. So I think Rolex, you know, it has an extraordinarily narrow platform of choice. And with a really great business, you can also kind of demand that people accept, you know, modest amounts of choice, so that they end up feeling like they belong to the privileged set of people who deserve to be there, which is how each of the three of those companies market their business. And I think they can do that. I think they've all done it better than have the big diversified houses that have, you know, purses and shoes and all the other things that take their attention away from finding those single units that they focus on recurring every year without the breath of fashion, which the others have sort of inhaled because of the mixed nature of their portfolio of companies.
All right. Okay. This is going to be our last question of the day before we wrap it up. But
thank you, Sydney.
No problem. Thank you. My last question is, what are your tips for retail investors to implement your strategy in small caps in developed or developing markets?
Yeah, you know, I would unfortunately most likely fall back on the advice that Warren's been giving people about how they might deploy their own capital, and I think in each case he's basically been saying, you know, go with the S&P 500. Now, you know, that won't necessarily give you a small cap exposure, but there's kind of the Russell 3000 or something. But his point has been, you know, the if you go with a resolve that you will stay and that you'll redeploy all of the dividends back into the shares and don't sell when the market's soft, you will get what markets get over time, and over time they've historically been reasonable returns. They haven't matched Warren's 19% compound annual return for 50 years, but nobody will. And the real risk that you would face is that you find yourself with somebody who says they will, and swing for the fences and risks your capital. And so I think the reason why he's been so adamant about sticking with his advice that his wife, upon death of him, should buy S&P 500 and bonds sufficiently enough to support their lifestyle for the rest of time, with the balance going into an equity index fund, I can't fault it, because it takes the emotion away, and you're not apt to sell out at the bottom or try to creep back in at the top, and you won't likely have a brokers asking you to step up and buy heavy load products that transfer a good portion of your money to their pocket. All and right. that's the agency cost question. So anyways, thank you for the chance to visit with your assembled.
Well, thank you, Tom. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much for coming on and giving us this great presentation, and for taking time to answer questions from our audience. If anybody missed anything, like I said earlier, there's a full recap of this presentation, as well as Tom's past appearance for us on Value Investing Live, available here on YouTube, as well as on Guru Focus. That's all the time we have for today, so we do wish you the best with all your current and future investments. See you all next time.
Thank Graham, and thank Charles. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.